Chapter 31. The warehouse had rusted iron ribs holding up the roof, and what little light there was inside came from hundreds of tiny bright speckles of sun showing through lacy holes in the siding. It was a big place, close to 300 feet long, but largely empty, except for unexplained piles of abandoned equipment and scrap metal. The floor was concrete, worn smooth in some places, stained with oil in others, and covered with rusty fragments and pigeon feathers everywhere. The crunch of the tires and the engine noise and the beat of the exhaust came back loud through Chang's open window. There were no people inside, as far as Reacher could see, which fact the back part of his brain seized upon. One blow to the side of the driver's head would solve the problem. A right-handed haymaker, around and down a little, unexpected, no warning. Give the guy some whiplash of his own. Get your retaliation in first. Reacher's hand balled into a fist, ready. And then it relaxed again. The guy drove on, slow and steady, but confident, as if he knew exactly where he was going, as if he had been there many times before, and he said,
"The hare and the tortoise, my friend. I just saved us 20 minutes.
At the far end of the warehouse was an identical busted door, hanging open just the same, and the guy drove out through it into the bright light and over more cracked concrete between more abandoned sheds and out a sagging gate onto LAX's northern perimeter road just outside the big wire fence. Reacher saw the control tower dead ahead, and runways and taxiways and parked planes and little trucks swarming all around, busy and innocent under the high sky and the blazing sun. The driver said,
"We were trespassing, technically, but I used to work in there, back when it was a going concern, so I figure I'm entitled. It saves using the regular way in off the freeway, which will be a real mess right now. It always is in the afternoon. I lose a buck or two on the meter, but I make it back double because I get a new fare all the faster. My secret sauce. A little local knowledge never hurts."
He turned right on a cargo road and followed the outside of another big wire fence, and 10 seconds later they were back in the river of town cars and taxis and friends and relatives, all heading for the terminals. A minute after that, they were at American, slowing down, pulling over, and stopping. Another minute, and Chang's suitcase was out on the sidewalk, upright, handle raised and ready to go, and the driver was paid and tipped and pulling away again. Chang got flimsy paper boarding passes from a machine, and then they headed for the security line. They didn't get there. A guy stepped in the way. He was about 40, pink and solid, with short, fair hair. He was wearing tan chinos and a blue polo shirt under a blue warm-up jacket. All the garments looked institutional, a uniform of sorts. He was wearing a lanyard around his neck. It was tangled, and the badge on the end was turned the wrong way around. He said,
"Ma'am, sir, I watched you walk inside from the curb."
Reacher said,
"Did you?"
"You passed by the curbside bag drop and used a no-checked bags machine."
"Did we?"
"Sir, you have no luggage. Nothing checked, no carry-on, not even a personal item."
"Is that a problem?"
"Frankly, sir, yes, it is. It's unusual behavior. It's one of the things on our list."
"Whose list?"
The guy stared for a second, and then he figured it out and glanced down to where his ID was hanging backward. He made a little noise in his throat, either irritation or frustration, and he flipped the badge around. Reacher saw a pink thumbnail photograph on the right, and the blue letters LAPD on the left, plus a bunch of lines too small and pale to read. The guy said,
"Counterterrorism."
Reacher said, "I agree. Having no luggage is statistically rare. That's a matter of simple observation. But I don't see why negative inferences need to be drawn."
"I don't make the rules.
You'll have to come with me, I'm afraid. Both of you?"
Chang said,
"Where?"
"To talk to my boss."
"Where is he?"
"In the van at the curb."
Reacher glanced out the sliding doors and saw a dark blue panel van parked in the no-waiting lane about 30 yards away. Not very clean, not very shiny.
"Surveillance," the guy said.
"And by boss, I mean my watch supervisor for the day. Not my real boss. The man in the van has the responsibility. It's that simple. This is pure routine. No big deal at all."
Reacher said,
"No."
"Sir, that's not a word right now. This is national security."
"No,
this is an airport. This is where people get on airplanes, which is what we're going to do, with one bag between us. So either arrest us or step aside."
"That kind of attitude is on the list, too, higher or lower than the no luggage thing."
"Sir, you're not helping yourself."
"In what endeavor?"
The guy got all tensed up, and a pair of LAPD uniforms strolled into view with all kinds of hardware on their bulky hips. Then the guy breathed out with the same kind of sound as before, either irritated or frustrated, and he said,
"Okay, you folks have a safe flight."
And he walked on, diagonally, already scanning the middle distance for new alerts. Chang's gold card guy had gotten them some kind of pre-approved status on their boarding passes, which let them use a special line through security and keep their shoes on. Reacher put his coins in a bowl and raised his hands in the scanner and joined Chang on the other side. They walked to the gate and found a lounge nearby that more gold card coding let them in, and they waited a good long time on upholstered chairs, which they agreed were the modern-day equivalents of the old mahogany benches at the railroad stop in Mother's Rest, in that both were more comfortable than they looked, which the modern-day equivalents needed to be, because theirs was not the first flight out, which Reacher eventually figured was the gold card downside. Then they boarded, and the gold card guy came through strong again, with seats in the exit row, which meant more leg room, which Reacher obviously appreciated, yet also resented. He understood the theory. In an emergency, people would have to exit that way, out through the window and over the wing. Hence, all kinds of regulations mandated a minimum space, so people would be comfortable on their way through, except that if such a thing existed as a minimum space for a person to be comfortable, then why wasn't every row just as capacious? It was a regulatory conundrum he couldn't unravel. Chang said,
"This is nice."
Reacher said, "It sure is."
"Why didn't you like that cop in the airport?"
"I liked him fine. I like everyone. I'm a happy, cheerful, and gregarious person."
"No, you're really not."
"I liked him fine," Reacher said again.
"You reacted to him in a negative way."
"Did I?"
"You said no to him, and then you started pushing him. You were practically daring him to arrest us."
"I had a question."
"Which was what?"
"I mean, I thought he was plausible. Very plausible, really. We've both seen it happen. Some upstairs pointy head writes a list, based on what no one knows.
Maybe 9 times out of 10, no luggage means you're a bad guy. Except my guess would be nearer 1 in a million. His shoe, probably. But he sticks to the list, because he has to.
So what was your question?
Have you seen an LAPD photo ID recently to compare?
I can't recall.
Me neither.
You think he was phony?
I wish I knew. I guess if he wasn't, at least he was proving the mind control thing was bullshit. Otherwise, he would have been happy I wasn't checking bags. I would have been leaving more room in the hold for the machinery.
If he was phony, who could he be, really?
Maybe he was another Moynihan cousin.
In L.A.? How many can there be? I don't buy it.
Why did he quit when he did?
Because you convinced him. He had no probable cause, and most likely he needed some. The legislation is probably weaker than we think it is.
Nah. He quit when he did, because the cops came close.
They were his.
But suppose they weren't. Suppose he was a con man whose job it was to get us in the van. But hey, nothing is that important. He's a pro who wants to work again. He wasn't sure what I was going to do next. I might have gone ballistic. He couldn't risk attention. So he shut it down, because the cops happened to wander close, prowling around looking for unusual behaviors. In other words, the guy covered his ass and ran.
Or he was a good soldier who spared you an hour in jail and himself an hour of paperwork by taking a deep breath and counting to 10 and walking away.
The plane turned onto the runway amid noisy billows of dry brown air, and it accelerated slowly, complacently, as if fully aware the mysteries of flight had been worked out long ago, and it lifted off calmly and glinted in the sun, and side-slipped in the haze, and curved upward on trails of soot, setting a dark but graceful course north and east. 10 minutes later, 20 miles south of Mother's Rest, the man with the ironed jeans and the blow-dried hair took the call on his landline. His contact said,
"We're going to put this right."
"Put what right?"
"We got very unlucky."
"What are you talking about?"
"There was a problem."
"Did they get on the plane?"
At which point the contact went talkative again, not from high spirits, from a bitter and incredulous should-have obsession. He said,
"Hackett set it up perfectly. She booked the flight on the phone, so he had all the details. The timing was perfect to the second. He watched them leave the motel in a taxi. He was in the back of a town car by then with a subcontractor driving, and they followed for a spell, and then they got alongside on the 405, and it was a total gimme, including she even had her window open, and the fast lane was moving well for the getaway, and the black town car on the road to LAX is invisible, because there are a million of them. So the shotgun was literally coming up right then, point-blank range, but they got rear-ended by a Ferrari. Like getting kicked into next week, Hackett said. They never saw them again. You can't move backward on a freeway."
"So they're on the plane?"
"It wasn't the earliest flight. They chose it because she has a gold card. Hackett is ahead of them by 34 minutes. I told you, we're going to put this right."
"In Chicago?"
"No extra charge. It wasn't our Ferrari, but it is our reputation."
"Don't let them talk to McCann."
"Understood. Our thoughts exactly."
The flight was long, not coast to coast, but basically transcontinental. A big slice, if not the whole thing. Chang had her seat reclined an inch, and her legs were stuck out straight, with her lace-up shoes under the seat in front. She was thinking, like he had seen her think before, behind the wheel of the little green Ford, on the long, empty road to Oklahoma City, sometimes half-smiling, and then half-grimacing, as positives and negatives ran through her mind, or strengths and weaknesses, or good outcomes and bad. Without a road to watch, her eyes were involved, too, narrowing, squinting, widening, shifting focus far and near. Reacher was trying not to think. He was chasing an elusive memory, right in the twilight between conscious and subconscious. He was looking away from it, not thinking about it, leaving it well alone. He said, "The library will be closed when we get there." She said, "We'll hit it first thing in the morning. We'll stay the night in a hotel." "We should make it a good one. We should stay in the best hotel in town and send the bill to the newspaper. A big suite with room service. They'll be happy to pay, because something is coming. I can feel it."
"What, exactly?"
"I don't know. There's something I can't remember, but I know it's important."
"How, if you can't remember?"
"Just a feeling."
"Because the best hotel in town will go on my credit card first. I'll be taking a financial risk."
"They'll be happy to pay," Reacher said again.
"Four Seasons or the Peninsula?"
"Either one."
"I'll call from O'Hare and take whichever is cheaper."
Reacher said nothing.
Chang said,
"Exactly how important do you think this thing is, that you can't remember but know is important?"
"I think it's going to give us a shape of what we're up against."
"What is?"
"I don't know. It's like I'm trying to match two things. Two things have been identical, but I don't know what. Words, or facts, or places."
"Not places. L.A. is nothing like Mother's Rest. There's no similarity at all."
"Okay."
"Neither is Chicago, except maybe some of the farmers go there to do whatever farmers do in Chicago." "Is that it?"
"No."
"You better hurry up. We're going to be there soon."
Reacher nodded absently. "We're going to be there soon." He pictured the deep planning process in his mind. He liked to think things through and scope things out, even something as simple as getting off a plane. It was a lizard brain thing. They would taxi and park, and the seatbelt sign would go off, and people would stand and wrestle stuff out of the overheads and from under the seats, and they would pack together in the aisle and eventually shuffle one by one to the door and out to the jet bridge. Then the race would be on for real, down the long, wide corridors, past the silvery boutiques, past the food courts, with their laminate tables and their lonely customers. Which was when he got it. He said, "Not words, or facts, or places." She said,
"What then?"
"Faces," he said. "Do you remember that town car on the 405?
"There were a million town cars on the 405.
One of them pulled alongside and kept pace for a second, and then got rear-ended by a red coupe.
"Oh, that one."
"Its window came down. I caught a glimpse of the guy inside."
"How much of a glimpse?"
"Partial and extremely brief."
"But?"
"We've seen him before."
"Where?"
"In the diner in Inglewood. That brown place. This morning. where we met with Westwood the first time. That guy was in there, elbows on the table, reading a newspaper. Now Chang said nothing.
Same guy, Reacher said. I was trained to think like a defense attorney.
And whatever you're going to say, the front part of my brain agrees with you, 100%. It was a split-second glimpse between two vehicles moving at 40 miles an hour, and eyewitness testimony is unreliable at best.
But?
The back part of my brain knows it was the same guy.
How?
The radio chatter is off the scale.
You hear radio chatter?
I listen out for it hard. We were wild animals for 7 million years. We learned a lot of lessons. We should be careful not to lose them.
What is the radio chatter saying?
Part of it is tuning up for a fight. It knows nothing good is coming.
What about the other part?
It's having a back and forth, working out the implications, which are basically all or nothing. Either I'm completely mistaken, or that guy has been following us from the start, which would mean he's tracking us through your cell phone, which would mean he knows virtually everything so far, and which would mean we better call the Four Seasons or the Peninsula from a payphone. That way, we'll get ahead. And we need to get ahead, because this guy is escalating. He's moving right along. At breakfast this morning in the diner, he was observing. Maybe eavesdropping a little, reading lips. Now, he's trying to kill us.
By opening his window,
he looked at me. For a split second, I thought he wanted to tell me something. He was kind of locking in on me in a preparatory way, but not ahead of him telling me something. He was acquiring his target. That's what he was doing. Logic says he had a sawed-off shotgun in there with him for a car-to-car drive-by, like an air-to-air missile. 2 rounds to make sure, and then everyone panics and crashes, and he gets away in the fast lane. And afterward, he was just one town car in a million, like you said.
That's a very extreme scenario.
It's all or nothing. What else was he doing, pulling level like that? He's been told to take us out, which suggests he's versatile and therefore expensive, which starts to give us a shape for what's happening in Mother's Rest. They're supplying something. In exchange for money. Enough money to hire a versatile private operative to counter a perceived threat.
Unless, like you said, it was a split-second glimpse at 40 miles an hour, 2 moving vehicles, and eyewitness testimony is unreliable.
Hope for the best, plan for the worst.
That wouldn't get us a warrant.
Warrants are about what you can prove, not what you know.
And you know.
It's an instinct thing. It's why I'm still here after 7 million years. Darwinism in action.
She said, what did we do between breakfast time and now to make them escalate?
Exactly, he said. We homed in on McCann.
Who must therefore be very dangerous to them, and therefore very interesting to us.
And the library will be closed when we get there.
She said, if he's the same guy, you could still be wrong.
But the smart money says we should act like I'm right. Just in case.
Like Pascal's wager.
Costs us nothing if we're wrong, but saves us plenty if we're right.
Except he's behind us now. He's still in L.A.
Not necessarily. This was not the first flight out.
Chang said nothing. She just took out her phone and held down a button and changed it from airplane mode to off completely.
They landed from the east after a long, lazy loop over the lake and the city. A summer dusk was almost done, still bronze and hot, but darkening. The lights on the runways were bright. They taxied and parked, and the seatbelt sign went off, and people stood up and wrestled things out of the overheads and from under the seats, and they started to pack together in the aisle, Reacher and Chang among them. Chapter 32. Eventually, Reacher and Chang crabbed one at a time down the aisle to the airplane door and out to the jet bridge and then out to the concourse, which was packed full of 1,000 people, either sitting and waiting or hustling fast in every direction. Reacher had the unknown man's face front and center in his mind, like a most wanted photograph in the post office. And he scanned the crowds obliquely in the corner of his eye, looking away, not thinking, trusting his instincts to snag the resemblance, if it was there. It wasn't. The guy wasn't sitting, wasn't waiting, wasn't hustling in any direction. They walked together through the long concourse corridor, past people waiting outside restroom doors, past people lining up for coffee, past newsstands, past silvery boutiques, past fast food eateries with their laminate tables and their hunched solo travelers. Reacher scanned ahead for newspapers being read, for elbows on the table, for a familiar slope of shoulders, but he saw nothing. No guy. Not in the building. They made it to the airside exit and stepped out to landside, to baggage claim, and onward toward the door for ground transportation, and they saw a wall of payphones, lonely and ignored. But better still, they found a concierge desk, which offered all kinds of helpful services to new arrivals, including hotel bookings made direct. A cheerful woman in a blazer recommended the Peninsula and made the call for them and got them a suite and told them where the cab line was. It was a warm evening, and the air outside was thick with humidity and gas fumes and cigarette smoke. They waited 5 minutes and got a tired guy in a tired Crown Vic, who took off for town as fast as he could. Reacher watched out the window until the airport crowds were gone, but he saw no faces he knew. On the highway, he watched the cars around them, but none pulled close or kept pace. They all just rolled along through the evening dark, individually, oblivious, all lit up in worlds of their own. Chang said,
"We should buy a burner phone."
Reacher said, "And we should tell Westwood to buy one, too, because that's how our guy got this whole thing started, presumably. He was sitting on Westwood, monitoring his calls. We came to him this morning. We walked right into it."
"Which proves they're worried about Westwood, which confirms something Westwood wrote is highly relevant."
"Probably not the sharks and the Frenchmen."
"Or the gerbils, or the climate change."
"See? We're narrowing it down already." They came in parallel to the L tracks and saw the great city huge and high and implacable in front of them, by that time a purely nighttime vista, with a million lit windows against an inky eastern sky. The Peninsula Hotel was ready and waiting for them, with a suite twice as large as the service bungalows Reacher had grown up in, and 1,000 times plusher. The room service menu was the size of a phone book and bound in leather. They ordered whatever they wanted, on the assumption the L.A. Times would pay. They ate it slowly, on the assumption they had the whole night ahead, uninterrupted, no need to rush. Better to savor the certainty. Better to bask in the upcoming promise. Through appetizers and entrees and desserts, and coffee. They woke early the next morning, despite the time zones, partly because they had things on their minds, but mostly because they hadn't bothered to close the drapes the night before, and the bedroom faced east, where it caught the morning sun. What was on Reacher's mind was his theory, which had suffered further revision. The fourth time had been better than the third. Hard to believe, but true. Which was bittersweet, because one day it would have to be average. It had to stop somewhere, sooner or later. It couldn't keep on getting better forever. Could it? Hope for the best, plan for the worst. Apparently what was on Chang's mind was Lincoln Park, and an irony, because she said, "I'm wondering how to get there. It's pretty close. I'm not sure it's worth renting a car. It might be hard to park. And taxis will add up and might be hard to find. So overall, I'm thinking we should get a town car for the day. Preferably black."
"Through the hotel," Reacher said. "Another layer of staying ahead."
"Pick up at 9. We'll be at the library about 10 minutes after it opens."
Outstanding.
Which, because of the early hour, gave them plenty of time for a long, slow room service breakfast and long, slow showers after other things best done long and slow in the morning, including the testing of theories. Their town car was the traditional sedan, black in color as requested, and waxed to a shine. Its driver was a small man in a gray suit. He professed himself equally happy to drive through traffic or sit at a curb. No skin off his nose. He was getting paid either way. It took him 10 minutes to Lincoln Park. The library had a start-of-the-day feel when they stepped inside. There was a little discreet bustling going on, getting things ready. They asked for the woman they had spoken to on the phone the day before, on the inquiries number, after touching 9, and they got directions from one helpful staffer after another, like a relay race, all the way to a desk labeled Inquiries, which stood alone in a side alcove and which was currently unattended. Its chair was neatly tucked in, and its computer screen was blank, as yet undisturbed. The inquiries lady was late for work. But all was not lost, because in the end wall of the alcove was a door, and behind the door were voices, and on the door was a sign, Volunteer Room, from inside of which McCann had made 15 calls. Until Westwood had run out of patience. Reacher knocked on the door, and the voices fell silent. He opened the door and saw a break room, very municipal, full of inoffensive colors and low chairs with fabric upholstery. In the chairs were 5 people, 2 men, 3 women, different ages, different types. The phone was on a low table between 2 of the chairs.
Excuse me, Reacher said. I'm sorry to interrupt. I'm looking for Mr. McCann.
An old guy said, "He isn't here." And he said it in a way that made Reacher assume he knew McCann, possibly well, in order to answer with such authority, and to appoint himself spokesperson on the matter. He was a thin old specimen, with pleated, no-iron khaki pants and a full head of white hair, neatly brushed, and a tucked-in plaid shirt, like a retired person uniform. Retired from an executive position, probably, full of spreadsheets and data, still needing to feel wanted, or wanting to feel needed. Reacher asked him,
"When was the last time you saw Mr. McCann?"
3 or 4 weeks ago.
Is that usual?
He comes and goes.
These are volunteer positions, after all. I gather he has many other interests.
Do you know where he lives?
The old guy said, I'm sorry, but these are personal questions, and I have no idea who you are.
A short time ago, Mr. McCann hired a firm of private detectives to help him with a problem. We're the agents. We're here to help him.
Then you must know where he lives.
Reacher said quietly, Sir, may we speak alone?
Which hit the spot.
As far as the old guy's ego was concerned, he had been recognized as a cut above, as exactly the kind of man you pulled aside and brought closer to the center. He said to the other volunteers,
Would you give us the room? It's time to start work, anyway. You've all got things to do.
So the others trooped out, the younger man and three women, and Chang closed the door behind them, and she and Reacher sat down in places just vacated in a triangle with the old guy who hadn't moved. Chang said,
The agent who dealt with Mr. McCann is missing, I'm afraid, and the first thing we need to do in a case like this is make sure the client is safe. That's our standard operating procedure. But we're going to need help finding him.
The old guy said,
What's this about? We don't know exactly. Maybe you can help us there, too. We think Mr. McCann is all worked up about something. Maybe he mentioned it?
I know he's not a happy man.
Do you know why?
We aren't close. We don't exchange confidences. We have a working relationship. We talk about library matters, of course, often at length, and we agree on most of them. But I recall very little personal conversation.
I get the impression he has family problems. That's as much as I can tell you. I think his wife is long dead and his grown-up son is an issue.
Or a challenge, as they would say nowadays. Do you know where he lives?
No, he never told me.
Reacher said, Isn't that unusual? Don't people normally talk about where they live? The stores on their block, or how far they have to go for a cup of coffee?
The old guy said,
I got the strong impression he was ashamed of where he lived.
They left the old guy in the room and found the inquiries lady at work at her desk outside. She had showed up, just in time. Chang renewed their acquaintance and showed one of her defunct FBI cards, and it was all going as smoothly as could be, but still the woman wouldn't give up McCann's address. She was unmovable. She was passionate on the subject of privacy. She said a request could be made to the director. But Reacher figured the director would be equally passionate. Maybe not on the subject of privacy, but certainly on the subject of possible litigation, and therefore just as unmovable. He said, Okay, don't tell me the address, but at least tell me if Mr. McCann has an address. The woman said,
Of course he has.
And you know what it is?
Yes, I do, but I can't tell you.
Is it local?
I can't give you the address.
I don't want it. I don't care about the address anymore. I wouldn't listen if you told me. I just want to know if it's local, that's all. Which doesn't give anything away. Every neighborhood has thousands of people.
Yes, it's local.
How local? Does he walk here the days he works?
You're asking me for his address.
No, I'm not. I don't want his address. I wouldn't even let you tell me now. I would stick my fingers in my ears and sing la la la. I just want to know if it's walking distance. It's a geography question. Or physiology. How old would you say Mr. McCann is?
How what?
Old. His age is different than his address. You're free to talk about it. You're free to share your impressions.
He's 60. He was 60 last year.
Is he in good shape?
Hardly. He looks terrible.
That's too bad. In what way?
He's too thin. He doesn't look after himself. He takes no care at all.
Is he lacking in energy?
Yes, I would say so. He's kind of down all the time.
Then he wouldn't want to walk too far, would he? Let's say 3 blocks maximum. Would that be a fair conclusion?
I can't tell you.
A 3-block radius is 36 square blocks. That's bigger than Milwaukee. You wouldn't be telling me anything.
Okay, yes, he walks to work, and yes, it's a short walk, but that's it. I can't tell you anything else.
What's his first name? Can you tell us that?
It's Peter. Peter McCann.
What about his wife? How long has he been widowed?
I think that was all a long time ago.
What's his son's name?
It's Michael, I think. Michael McCann.
Is there an issue with Michael?
We didn't talk about it.
But you must have pieced something together.
I would be betraying a confidence.
Not if he didn't tell you himself. You would be sharing your own conclusions. That's all. That's a big difference.
I think Mr. McCann's son, Michael, has a behavioral issue. I don't know what exactly. Not something to be proud of, I think. That would be my conclusion.
Richard made a sympathetic face and tried one last time, but still she wouldn't give up McCann's address. So they took their leave and detoured to the reference desk and checked the Chicago phone books. There were too many P. McCanns and too many M. McCanns to be useful. They stepped back out to the street, armed with precisely nothing except impressions and guesses. Chapter 33. They turned left on the sidewalk outside the library door and found the mom-and-pop pharmacy exactly where it should have been, which was directly adjacent. It was a narrow storefront with an awning and a door and a small display window which was full of not very tempting items, including elastic bandages and heat pads and a toilet seat for folks having difficulty with mobility. Pharmacy windows were a marketing challenge, in Reacher's opinion. It was hard to think of a display liable to make people rush inside with enthusiasm. But he saw one item of interest. It was a burner cell in a plastic package hanging on a peg on a board. The phone looked old-fashioned. The plastic package looked dusty. The price was advertised as super low. They went inside and found 6 more identical phones pegged to a panel otherwise covered with $2 cases and $2 chargers and car adapters and wires of many different descriptions, most of them white. The phones themselves were priced a penny shy of $13. They came preloaded with 100 minutes of talk time. Reacher said, "We should buy one." Chang said,
"I was thinking of something more modern."
"How modern does it need to be? All it has to do is work."
"It won't get the internet."
"You're talking to the wrong person. That's a feature as far as I'm concerned. And it's a karma thing. We'll have the same phone as McCann. It might bring us luck."
"Doesn't seem to have worked for him," Chang said.
But she unhooked the phone from the display anyway and carried it to the counter where an old lady waited behind the register. She had steel-gray hair in a bun, and she was dressed with last-century old-country formality.
way in the back of the store, was an old guy working on prescriptions. Same kind of age, same kind of style. A white coat over a suit and tie. Same kind of hair, apart from the bun. Mom and Pop, presumably. No other staff. Low overhead. Reacher asked the woman, "Do these phones have voicemail?" She repeated the question, much louder, not directed at him, he realized, but at Pop in back, who called out, "No!" The woman said,
"No."
Reacher said, "A friend of ours bought one here, Peter McCann, do you know him?" She called out loudly,
"Do we know Peter McCann?"
The old guy in back shouted, "No!"
"No,"
the woman said. "Do you know his son, Michael?"
"Do we know his son, Michael?" "No."
"No."
"Okay," Reacher said. He found a 10 and a 5 in his pocket, then paid for the phone. His change came in coins, expertly reckoned and deftly dispensed. They stopped on the sidewalk outside the store and wrestled the package open. Wasn't easy. In the end, Reacher gave up on finesse and tore it in half down the middle. He put the charger in his pocket and passed the phone itself to Chang. She looked it over and figured it out and turned it on. It came up with a welcome screen, small, blurred, and black and white. It showed its own number, area code 501 plus 7 more digits. It showed a battery icon at about 50% capacity, charged at the factory, but not all the way. The icon was like a tiny flashlight battery, tipped over on its side, solid at one end and hollow at the other. Reacher said, "Try McCann again. Maybe this time he'll answer. Maybe his phone will recognize a kindred spirit." There was no speaker option. Not for $13. Chang dialed, and they stood together cheek to cheek, listening, her right ear, his left. And they heard McCann's phone ring, and ring, endlessly, the same as before. No answer, and no voicemail. Like a faithful spaniel, not understanding. Chang ended the call. She said,
"Now what? We search an area bigger than Milwaukee?"
"I was dramatizing for effect. Milwaukee is bigger than 36 blocks. It's a pretty nice place." Then he stopped. She said,
"What?"
He said, "Nothing." He had been about to say, "We should go there sometime." She said,
"Okay. We have to search an area smaller than Milwaukee, but not by much."
"A couple of blocks might do it, if we point ourselves in the right direction. This is a man who looks terrible because he doesn't take care of himself. Probably doesn't eat right, maybe doesn't sleep right. Probably won't go to the doctor, so he doesn't get prescriptions to fill. And he certainly isn't trawling the aisles, comparison shopping for vitamin pills. Pharmacies are not on his radar. He doesn't have a favorite. He's indifferent to them all. Therefore, he had no particular reason to buy his phone from this particular pharmacy. So why did he? Because he walks past it twice a day, to and from the library. How else would he even notice? They had one phone in the window, all covered with dust. So I think we can conclude he walks home in this direction. Out the library door, turn left, past the pharmacy and onward."
"To where?"
"I think this is a pretty nice neighborhood. I think the real estate here is solid. But apparently McCann is ashamed of where he lives." "What does that mean? You see anything around here you'd be ashamed to live in?"
"I'm not McCann."
"Exactly. It's all relative.
The old guy in the volunteer room looks like a retired CEO or something, and I'm sure he's local, and I'm sure he lives in a house. Pretty much impossible to have a shirt like that without living in a house. The two things go together, practically a requirement. Probably some kind of a nice brownstone on a quiet, leafy street. Therefore, if it's relative, McCann doesn't live in a house. But not in an apartment, either. Apartments are perfectly legitimate alternatives to houses. Better in some ways. Certainly nothing to be ashamed about. So McCann lives in something less than a house, but not an apartment.
A broken-up house, Chang said. A not very nice brownstone on a not very leafy street, all divided up into separate rooms. Probably not still cooking on electric hot plates, but close, which is hard for one guy to admit to another guy, especially when the other guy has a brownstone all to himself. Maybe the exact same brownstone, same builder, same plan. But his street didn't fall on hard times, which is way too pointed for testosterone to bear.
That's how I see it, Reacher said. Roughly, maybe not the hormonal stuff, but two or three blocks in this direction, we're going to find a couple of streets of tumble-down row houses, each with about a dozen bells on the door. And those kind of bells usually have labels next to them, sometimes with names on. And with a bit of luck, we'll find one of those names is McCann. There were plenty of names, because there were plenty of labels, because there were plenty of bells, because there were four streets, not a couple, and they were long. The first two turned left and right off the main drag, two blocks after the library, and the third and the fourth came another block further out. They were low-rise enclaves between taller buildings, not shoehorned in, but there from the beginning. There was nothing off-putting or unpleasant about them, no trash in the gutters, no busted syringes crunching underfoot, no graffiti, no rot or decay, nothing overt. But somehow the mysterious and unforgiving calculus of real estate had downgraded them. Maybe there were missing trees, or damp in the basements, or too much window AC. Maybe the breeze blew wrong. Maybe way back, a poor widow had split up her house to make ends meet, and then another, and another. Image was a very subtle thing. They had their town car quarter the neighborhood at a slow speed, to establish the search area's boundaries. Then they had the guy park, and they got out to walk. The sun was over the lake, and the light was sharp with reflections. It was already hot, 2 hours before noon. Chang took the sunny side of the street, and Reacher stayed in the morning shadows. They moved door to door, separately, unsynchronized, up brownstone stoops and down again, like restaurant workers delivering menus or missionaries seeking converts. Richard found that most bell buttons had names against them, some handwritten, some typed, some printed, some embossed on narrow black tape and stuck over previous tenants. There were Polish names and African names and South American names and Irish names, a whole United Nations right there. But on the first street, at least, none of the names was McCann. 20 miles south of Mother's Rest, the man with the iron jeans and the blow-dried hair took another call on his landline. His contact said, "She's not using her phone anymore."
"Why not?"
"Hard to say. A precaution, possibly. She's ex-FBI and he's ex-military. They're not babes in the wood."
"In other words, you're saying Hackett can't find them?"
No, he found them. He found them real easy. He watched the library. They showed up right on time. They were inside for half an hour, and then they bought a burner phone in the drugstore next door.
So what is he waiting for?
Opportunity. They must not talk to McCann. Don't worry. That ain't going to happen. I can promise you that.
They crossed the main drag and entered the second street, up brownstone stoops and down again, house by house. Most places seemed to have three floors with up to four separate dwellings on each. The names kept on coming. One place had Javier, Hiroto, Giovanni, Baker, Friedrich, Ishiguro, Aquame, Engelman, Krupke, Dassler, Leonidas, and Callahan. Perfectly alphabetical, if you changed the order. The first 12 letters, and Callahan at least was Irish. But it wasn't McCann. The houses themselves had touches of faded glory. There were remnants of stained glass and Victorian tile. The front doors were crusted with layers of paint, and most of them had pebble glass panels with blurred and hazy views of inside lobbies, with shapes that might have been parked bicycles or baby carriages. Reacher moved on, door to door, one place after another, the end of the street coming close, the search nearly half over, and he didn't find McCann. But Chang did. She waved from across the street, from the stoop of a house just like all the others, and he raised his palms in a semaphored question, and she pumped her fist discreetly, like a golfer after a long but successful putt. He crossed the street and joined her, and she pointed at the bell box and ran an elegant nail over a ribbon of white paper neatly printed with the name Peter J. McCann.
Chapter 34. McCann's digs were listed as apartment 32, which Reacher figured was the second apartment on the third floor, possibly a back room if they were counting clockwise from the front left, as was likely. A top-floor walk-up, in other words, with no view. In an unremarkable building on a second-rate street, location was working against the guy. The street door was stout and securely locked. Chang pressed McCann's call button. They heard no sound inside. Too far away, presumably. There was no crackling reply over the speaker. Nothing at all. Just a hot, quiet morning with nothing stirring. Reacher said, "Try his phone again." Their burner had a redial facility. Not bad for $13. Chang hit it, and they waited cheek to cheek. It rang and rang. No answer. She killed the call. She said,
"Now what?"
"Too early for pizza," Reacher said. "We'll have to be UPS. He pressed 9 separate buttons, and when the first of them answered, he said, "Package delivery, ma'am." There was a pause, and then the door lock buzzed and clicked. They went inside through a hot vestibule with bikes and baby carriages and drifts of Thai menus and locksmith's cards into a downstairs hallway that bore traces of family living from 100 years before, with crown moldings and wallpaper. But the wallpaper was faded and scuffed, and the moldings were cruelly terminated by crude partitions, and the elegant parlor doors had 5-lever locks butchered into them, and spy holes, and brass numbers screwed on not exactly level. First on the left was 11, with 12 behind it, further on down the hallway. The staircase was ornate and carpeted and steep. Automatic lights came on as they passed every dogleg. They got to the top, breathing hard. It was hot up there. Unit 32 was the first door they came to, back corner on the left. Reacher knocked. No answer. But the way the door rattled in the frame didn't sound right. Reacher tried the handle. The door was unlocked. The door opened straight into a living room, and that was pretty much the whole apartment, right there. Dark, but small enough for a single glance. There was hot air and a sour smell, and an unmade twin-size bed against one wall, and a windowless RV-size kitchenette, and a windowless RV-size bathroom side by side on another. The only light in the place came from a bay window, which was dark with soot and had drapes only half pulled back. The walls were bare and might once have been white, but they had long ago grayed over to the color of ash. There was a bar-height eating table, no wider than an oil drum, and a single stool. There was a lone armchair and an ottoman that didn't match, except it was worn shiny in the same kind of way. And that was it for variety in terms of furniture. Everything else was tables. There were 5 tables in all, each one about the size of a door, about 6 feet long, about 3 feet wide, all of them made of wood and stained black. Together, they dominated the whole apartment. They were arranged in a line down the center of the room, in a pattern, the first end on, the second buttered up sideways, making a T-shape, the third end on again, the fourth sideways, another T, the fifth and last end on again, the whole array looking like a rigid backbone running through the dismal space, like vertebrae and stubby ribs. On the tables were computers, 7 of which were desktops, and 8 of which were laptops. There were other unexplained black boxes and external hard drives and modems and USB hubs and power supplies and cooling fans. But above all, there were wires, great bales and billows of kinked and tangled cables like rats' nests gone haywire. And where there weren't either wires or boxes, there were books. High, teetering piles of them, all about technical aspects of coding and hypertext protocols and domain name allocation. Chang checked the hallway and closed the door behind them. Reacher said, "Try his phone." She hit redial, and he heard a purr of ringtone against her ear, and then the cell network clicked in, and a phone started to ring in the room. It was loud and insistent. It was ringing and buzzing with a stupid tune and the thick vibration of plastic on wood. McCann's phone was right there, on a table, hopping around under a nest of wire, its little front window all lit up blue. It was plugged into a charging wire, which was plugged into a computer. Chang killed the call. She said,
"Why doesn't he have it with him? A cell phone belongs in a pocket."
Reacher said, "To him, it's not a cell phone, I guess. Not in the normal way. It was an alternate number for calling Westwood, that's all. And it did its job. Not its fault, there was no result. So like you figured, he gave it up and dumped the phone in a drawer. Except the drawer is a table."
"Plugged in."
"Habit, maybe."
"So where is he?"
Reacher said, "I don't know where he is."
"Kiefer's door was unlocked, too."
"I remember."
"I think we should take a quick look and get out."
"How quick?"
2 minutes."
Which wasn't much, but which was enough, because there wasn't much to look at. The kitchen was tiny, with a half-size cabinet that held only a box of off-brand breakfast cereal and a half-size refrigerator that held only a quart of off-brand milk and 2 candy bars. The bathroom cabinet had legal analgesics and over-the-counter cold remedies. There was a chest of drawers full of threadbare clothing, most of it man-made material and all of it black. There was nothing unusual about the bed. The computer equipment was what it was. All the screens lit up on command, but from that point onward, every step of every way needed a password. No photos, no personal items, no leisure reading, no stacks of mail. Chang opened the door and checked the hallway. She said,
"Let's go."
She opened the door wider. There was a guy standing there. Eyewitness testimony was suspect because of preconditions and cognitive bias and suggestibility. It was suspect because people see what they expect to see. Reacher was no different. He was human. The front part of his brain wasted the first precious split second working on the image of the guy at the door, trying to rearrange it into a plausible version of a theoretical McCann, which was not an easy mental task, because McCann was supposed to be 60 years old and thin and gaunt, whereas the guy at the door was clearly 20 years younger than that, and twice as solid. But still, Reacher tried, instinctively, because who else could it be but McCann? Who else could be at McCann's door, in McCann's building, in McCann's city? Then, half a second later, the back part of Reacher's brain took over, and the image resolved itself, crisp and clear. Not a potential McCann at all, not even remotely a contender, but the familiar, twice-glimpsed face, now three times seen, first in the diner, next in the town car, and finally in the there and then in a dim upstairs hallway in a three-floor walk-up.